Who can say where the killer roams? When the blood flows, it's slaying time. Slay away. Slay away. Slay away.
Where we discuss the inspiration behind your favorite horror films, lore, gore, and every kill in between. I'm your host, E.L. King.
We're here today with Matt from Gun Media.
Hey, everybody, what's going on?
I'm super excited to chat with you today and talk about all things horror. And so can you tell us a little bit about what you do at Gun?
The role of lead community developer, it's a tricky role to explain to people. As soon as people hear the words community, they think, oh, all right, cool. So you just hang out on social. And, not that there's anything wrong with those roles. I think that even at the base of a community role, it's more than quote unquote hanging out on social. But lead community developer, it's an interesting gig. You know, I not only am I in charge currently of kind of managing the communities around the games that Gun represents, but also how we would develop a community around potential future releases and new titles. So it's more than just interacting and trying to keep our current community thriving, but also, you know, trying to make sure that we're keeping the community in mind in everything we do moving forward. So it's kind of an interesting role. You know, it's more than managing, it's building, growing, and trying to figure out how we can facilitate better, community initiatives well into the future.
Awesome. Well, I know as a gamer myself, it's something we definitely appreciate. And if you're not familiar with Gun Media, Gun worked on games and represents games like Friday the 13th, The Game. And as someone who is a huge fan of 80s horror films and the Friday the 13th franchise, it was a really, really fun one for me. But then also Layers of Fear 2 from Bloober Team was another one they worked on. And I think, that release in 2018?
You're putting me on the spot now. Yes, May of 2018.
That's right. No. May of 2018. That, really good one. I thought it was a lot scarier, actually, than the first Layers of Fear game. And of course, Tony Todd lending his voice to the game was incredible. Yeah. So
one of the things that's important to note about Layers of Fear 2 and the differences between Layers of Fear 1 and Layers of Fear 2 is if you're a horror movie kind of, you know, horror junkie, like everybody in this call is, there's a lot of references in there to horror films throughout, you know, history. So whereas the first Layers of Fear focused on a painter and the medium of art that the painter was creating during their descent into madness, it was fine art and things like that. With Layers of Fear 2, it's a lot of film references because our protagonist is in the film industry. The protagonist is an actor, and they're interacting with the voice of Tony Todd playing the director. And so naturally, the content being revolving around filmmaking, there's a lot of really fun references to horror movies all throughout time in there. I mean, there's everything from modern horror like Seven going back to The Shining and Journey to the Moon. So there's a lot of cool references in there for sure.
Yeah, all films I'm a really, really big fan of personally. Especially, like, I know Stephen King's feelings on The Shining, Kubrick's version of The Shining, but I personally like it, and a lot of the films you reference, definitely big fans of those.
I want to correct myself. It was May 28th, 2019, because, you know, and I need to say one quick thing. COVID world has me completely screwed on any concept of time, calendar, day, year, anything. The world feels like a great big mushy lump of things happening, and trying to keep track of it all, honestly, is melting my brain these days. So yeah, May 28th, 2019, I was wrong. And this way I can just get that out of the way before anybody comes after me and goes, you don't even know when your own game came out, jerk, you know? So
yeah. If I didn't have my calendar open, I wouldn't know what day it was. So
right. The fact that we spent a whole year indoors means that, as terrible as it, I kind of feel like 2020 had to be a horrible year, because if it was anything less, if it was anything more mundane than a year of moments strung together that we're all going to talk about long into the future, we would have totally forgotten it. Because I mean, think about so many things. Like February, we went into work from home. So we had what, like a month and a half of 2020 normalcy before everything launched into, you know, lockdowns and things like that. So as terrible of a year as 2020 was, if it wasn't so terrible, I think it would be like stricken from the record, because there's so many things that I just didn't, normal things that I normally do, that I just didn't do for pretty much all of 2020, like go to the office and things like that. So yeah. Anyway, my internal calendar is beat.
I'm curious. I'm going to ask you, what experience do you feel has shaped your love of horror the most? And can you tell me a little bit about it?
One of the things that I always talk about on these podcasts and stuff is when I was real young, how Hellraiser affected me. You know, my first exposure to Hellraiser, as much as I had seen horror movies before that, I you know, I had an older sister and I had older cousins and stuff that used to like to try to scare me and put on horror movies and such. So I had been watching horror movies already when Hellraiser came out, but something about the release of the first Hellraiser just really sent me into like a like, it was a defining moment for me as a horror fan, probably because Hellraiser scared me before I knew anything about the movie. It scared me when all I saw was Pinhead, the full headshot of Pinhead making that snarly face and everything. And you know, it scared the hell out of me, that image. And the idea of that image scaring me so bad, but my own curiosity making me want to know more about it, was really, that's why that's the defining moment for me in horror, was that first Hellraiser film. Because like I said, that was the first time I noticed the concept of, I'm afraid of this, I'm shocked by it, I'm scared, but I just really want to know more about it. I really want to lean into being scared. And I was enjoying the feeling of being scared. So that really, to me, was the first moment that I was like, I'm kind of into this stuff. You know what I mean? Like, cause it's one thing to be scared by something and be like, oh, that was scary, you know? And it's another thing to be like, that was scary, give me more. And that was what I got out of Hellraiser.
Well, and it's scary, but it's also exhilarating someone who's maybe being molded into a horror fan, right? Like, there's people who get scared. They're like, I absolutely hate being scared. I don't like it. It's terrible. I hate any, like, people very much sway one way or the other. They absolutely hate horror, or they really, really love it. And I'm one of those people. I feel like I'm exhilarated by a horror film, especially one that's done right. I've spoken before about how I don't like films that are really like gore for the sake of gore, though. I like everything to have kind of a purpose. So I don't like anything that's just about shock and awe value. But I will say Hellraiser is one that still scares me to this day. Because it's done in such a way that just freaks me out. Like, it's something really creepy for me. And when I was a kid, one of the films that my grandmother first introduced me to, because she got me into horror, not the first film I ever saw, but like, I was probably five and I was watching Child's Play. Mm-hmm. And as a kid, that whole concept was really scary. And to this day, dolls freak me out.
Yeah.
So that's one that's definitely creepy for me. But yeah, I mean, and I love the fact that your family kind of got in on it and your sisters were trying to scare you.
Oh, yeah.
Scary movies on. Oh, do you remember some of the other scary movies that they would throw on television, you know, to creep you out?
The usuals, you know, we had Friday the 13th already. We had Halloween already, movies like that. Black Christmas, as much as that was out already, it wasn't one that I had caught up with until a little later in my kind of horror fandom. But yeah, the usuals. Like I said, we had a lot of the mainstays of 80s horrors were already out at the time that Hellraiser came out. So we already had those movies where it was, you know, we would go camping, for instance, every summer with my father, and they would chase me around the campground, you know, doing the kiki mama from Friday the 13th, trying to freak me out, you know. So growing up with older siblings and cousins and such, they just, you know, horror was an easy way to kind of pick on me, I guess. But there was, like I said, again, that real turning point with Hellraiser, where I was like, I got into the idea of being scared, and I got more of a, it was more of a thrill than a, oh God, stop, you know what I mean? So it kind of took a lot of the sting out of the cousin and sister torment there that was going on. But yeah.
That's funny, because when I think about it, I have a younger brother. I have quite a few siblings. I have 5 siblings, but my younger brother, and we're like across many different family dynamics. So my younger brother lived with me at the time, and I can remember horror films and horror games once that became a thing that we got into, that he would make me be the primary like watcher or player, and we had these blankets that we both had as kids, and he would like sit next to me, and he would like half hide underneath while I'm playing the game. And and even to this day, it's still that way. Like, I'm the horror junkie, and he's like the one that like he will watch, but he's not like, he's not into it like I am. So yeah. It's interesting to me.
Well, you know, one of the things that's notable about this time period, Hellraiser was 1987, right?
Yeah, it's fairly late in the decade.
Yeah, and I actually just checked up on it. I wanted to make sure I didn't misspeak, but so we already had, obviously we had Halloween with Michael Myers, 78. We had Friday the 13th, 1980. And then Nightmare on Elm Street, 1984, the original Nightmare on Elm Street. So like the big three were already out. And obviously Texas Chainsaw Massacre had happened. So even if you want to throw Leatherface in there, the big guns were already out for horror at that point. So Hellraiser was pretty late. So again, you had these movies drifting around that, like, you know, I mean, I was 7. I don't care if everybody here knows how old I am. I was 7 years old in 1987. So, you know, prior to that, my family would let me see some movies that were horror movies and such. And, you know, also obviously with an older sister, we were able to get away with seeing more horror movies. But, you know, it wasn't quite the same as when Hellraiser came out. You know, 1987, you've already got all the big guns. You know, horror is, for all intents and purposes, normalized at that point. You know, we've seen sequels to horror films. We've seen, you know, the big blow up of 80s horror that kind of happened, you know, that was already out in mainstream and in the open. So when Hellraiser came along, it was kind of, you know, kind of handy that Hellraiser was a little something different, you know, a lot of something different, really, and leaned into some themes that we were not seeing. This wasn't your usual, like, oh, you know, slasher going to get the teenagers in their dreams, or slasher going to get the teenagers at the camp, or slasher going to get the teenagers on Halloween night. This was a whole new thing about excess and demons and, you know, supernatural elements that can get you anywhere. You know, it broke a lot of molds and did a lot of things differently and stood out. So again, you know, the timing of it, the, you know, the kind of vibe in the world of horror at that time being very samey at that point, and being very kind of hitting a little bit of a rut, Hellraiser, for better or worse, you know, I think even people who don't like the Hellraiser franchise have to note that it definitely did a lot to kind of smash a lot of that stuff down and change things a bit. And you know, that's partly because Clive Barker's a freaking genius.
At the time I was growing up, it was still like 80s, early 90s. I remember playing the original Friday the 13th game on Nintendo. And just, it was funny because it's like this Technicolor type experience. And not as scary as the film, but it was just one of those things. Like, as I started to get into that, I knew I was being pulled like deeper into someone who was actively seeking out those experiences, versus just being excited when they came along, right? And then as we got to the end of the 80s and even early 90s, there was a lot to choose from, because there was just this explosion of horror films throughout the 80s. So, and the sequels included, like, Nightmare on Elm Street's a great example because there's a ton of sequels just in that time period. But I wanted to ask you, do you have a favorite movie monster from, like, are you a fan of the classic, like, Universal monster films as well?
Absolutely. I have a soft spot for my boy Frank, right? Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I have a soft spot for him, but I also really like Creature from the Black Lagoon, the original Wolfman, you know. But I think the one that... I'm doing that thing where I just name them all and I say, yeah, they're all my favorite.
We love all of them. It's hard not to love all of them because they're so, each is so unique and brings its own flavor to the genre, I feel like. And obviously, I think we all know I'm a big fan of, like, Bela Lugosi as Dracula. Yeah. Creature from the Black Lagoon is actually one of my favorites. And I'm a huge fan of the illustrated movie posters and art from the time period before movie posters all became just photographs and stuff. So Frankenstein's a big one. And as someone who's read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and seen a lot of the adaptations, I still go back to the classic in from the 1930s. I think it's 1930s, correct, for that one? I don't know if it is. I think it's even earlier, maybe 1920s. I'll have to look it up, but Creature from the Black Lagoon is one I like a lot. Why do you think you are into Creature from the Black Lagoon?
Well, honestly, I'm a fan of makeup and the creation of monsters. So, like, you know, one of the things that stands out to me about the original Universal monsters was the creativity that went into a lot of that makeup and presence that, you know, even the Wolfman, okay, we look at it now and we go, like, God, it looks like somebody taped a toupee on his face. But I mean, at the time, that was really out there and that was really something special. And I think that there was a lot of really cool creativity with those original Universal monsters, which is why, as much as I can sit here and say I like every single one of them and I, you know, I can kind of gush over every one of them and pour my heart out about each one, I think the Invisible Man is one of the most interesting, and that sounds contradictory to what I'm saying about makeup and makeup effects and such, because there's not a lot of makeup that goes into the Invisible Man. There's actually none. But there's a lot of creativity that goes into creating a monster in a time without the special effects of, like, you know, modern day, you know, remakes or retellings of that story. So there's a lot of him wrapped up in bandages. There's also a lot of, like, you know, things moving around the room on fishing line and such. And I think that for the time period, that was a very creative way to create an invisible, to make an invisible monster. I also think that there's something about the Invisible Man that's, I don't know if relatable is really the best way to put it, but that descent into madness that he suffers from and, you know, the concept of being invisible and, you know, feeling like, number one, you're kind of hedged in by that fact, you're invisible, and how that changes your life for the negative, but then also the slide down the slope of madness to how you can manipulate that and, you know, trying to maintain your sanity in that situation. There's something to the story of the Invisible Man that always kind of, I don't know, it hit me. I just think it's a really interesting way to create that kind of a monster, and it's a really interesting concept. It's not the Wolfman who, when the moon is full, he goes into this uncontrollable state and does things. It's a man, like, kind of tackling his own issues, and a person tackling their own well-being and their own mental health and their own state of mind as this terrible thing is kind of unfolding. And so not that I relate to the Invisible Man, he's obviously a villain, but it's a relatable thing, feeling invisible, feeling like, feeling that slip of not being, you know, of weakness almost, of it being a weakness and trying to turn it into a strength, and how slippery that could be and where that could take you.
Well, I think it's interesting because there's definitely, like, a correlation between a villain or monster like the Invisible Man and, like, what a lot of us are going through in 2020, being stuck indoors, right? We're isolated and there is a descent into madness with that, and the feelings that a lot of people are having, and even mental health, mental well-being, well-being in general, just beyond mental health. And like, yeah, you can say stuff on social media all you want, and there's a lot going on there in terms of like figuring out how you can feel seen, right?
That's one thing that I think I absolutely love about horror in general is how a lot of these villains do have something relatable. You know, like if we reference American Werewolf in London, it's the same thing, like where you're watching these changes and it speaks to like how we may feel sometimes. And, you know, from vampires with sexuality and whatnot. That's just the absolute cool thing for me about horror in general.
Yeah, I think a lot of these characters can be relatable to us as people. Right. Like, doesn't necessarily mean that, oh, I'm a villain, but you see something within yourself that you can tie to this, and that's why we love these films, I feel like. So yeah, I definitely agree with that. So beyond monsters, do you have a favorite horror movie killer or villain?
You know, beyond it's tough because
some might think villain of them as monsters, but I'm thinking more of like the slasher genre.
Right. So getting outside of universal monsters and that type of thing, or even just actual creatures, you know, when it comes to slashers and things like that, I really like Michael Myers. I do really like the kind of shark-like approach, you know, the quiet, just continuous pressure that Michael Myers brings to a horror film. I love Jason. I think that Jason is a very misunderstood villain in a horror film, you know. Basically, he was picked on and tormented, and then they killed his mom, and now he just wants his camp to go back to being quiet, you know? And so, like, there's relatable bits to them. I think Leatherface, for instance, protecting his home, wanting to protect his home from these interlopers that just show up and you know, I mean, at one point, they literally break into Leatherface's house, and then they wonder why he, you know, comes at them. I don't know. I wouldn't go walking into people's houses, whether the door's unlocked or not. So, you know, I think there's like this little bit of relatable kind of elements to each of the villains in all of our slashers that we really enjoy. I think that if you get outside of that, you have the Freddy, who there's not a whole lot that's relatable there. Freddy is a villain through and through. You have Pinhead, who's a villain through and through, you know. So I don't know. I think that there's something in me that wants to root for the bad guy, you know, wants to watch the He-Man cartoon and root for Skeletor. There's something in me that wants to root for the bad guy in all these films. And then there's something to be said for the films that leave you nothing to root for, you know. And so I don't know. It's definitely a tricky one, but I think I'm going to lean back on my usual answer. And I love Pinhead from Hellraiser. I do. I think that there's something about his no nonsense approach to what he's there to do. You know, I really think that there's something just so creative and cool about him and the entire idea of the engineer role in the Hellraiser kind of canon.
Yeah, it's interesting with Hellraiser because I think it may have actually been when I was watching In Search of Darkness that someone had said, like, when it comes to Hellraiser, it's not just that character of Pinhead that is necessarily the villain. In fact, the people in the film are more so the villains than even the, I'm going to pronounce it wrong, Cenobites?
Yeah, Cenobites. Yep.
Cenobites are. And that's interesting to me too. Like, think about the fact that the people in the film are, in some respects, the actual villains. And Hellraiser is just there to do his job.
Oh, absolutely. You see, the whole point of Hellraiser is if you seek hell, you'll find it. And, you know, the folks in that are opening the puzzle box and getting themselves in the situation to even meet the Cenobites, they're kind of seeking excess. They're living life to an extent that they should not be living. They're looking for their next high, their next thrill, their next, you know, whatever the case may be. And they're being pushed to like the furthest reaches of that kind of mindset of living to excess and you know, the kind of inquisitive nature of that kind of like search, right? So when Pinhead and the rest of the Cenobites show up, they're not there to be villains. They're honestly, you asked for it. You know, that's why that whole line of "you open the box, we came," like, this is what happens when you do this, you know, like when you seek out terrible shit will find you, you know, that's the way that goes. And the Cenobites are not necessarily the villains so much as they are the kind of the hand of that. They're the tool that enacts that kind of final act of, you know, seeking for darker and darker things in your life. And so, you know, again, they're not there for any reason other than to claim the souls that are put offering themselves up to be taken. So
it's funny because you mentioned that line from the film, and it brings me to this thought of, like, what for you, do you have any other sort of really stand out lines from a horror film? I know I have a couple that really, it's where you stop and you're like, oh my God. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, yeah. I'm like, I'm sorry to put you on the spot with that, but like, it's a great question because there's definitely some of those moments. For me, one of them is from The Strangers. That, you know, that ending line. I don't want to spoil for anybody, but this is a horror podcast, so you're just gonna have to deal with it. But
and you should have seen The Strangers by now, right?
If you haven't seen The Strangers by now, you should have seen it by now. But it's when they ask the question of, you know, why are you doing it this to us? Why are you doing this to us? And the reply is, well, you were home.
Yeah.
And that's just terrifying, right?
So simple.
It's one of the most terrifying lines in a movie ever, oddly enough, because it's so relatable. Like, oh my God, like someone could just show up at my door. Because, and it's similar to Reba, what you talked about in an earlier episode is we don't always know the reason for why people, even from a true crime perspective, go on these like killing sprees. There's no reason. They just do. And how they choose their victims is completely random. Some people have a pattern, some people don't. That's terrifying to me. So yeah, Matt, what are some just iconic lines for you?
Well, I mean, I keep talking about Hellraiser, and honestly, it's full of them. Like, there's something about when he looks at her and says, "No tears, it's a waste of good suffering," and your suffering will be legendary even in hell, you know, like, "You open the box, we came." There's just so much from Hellraiser that is just amazing, you know. Demons to some, angels to others. That's again Hellraiser. Like, it's just Hellraiser really has a lot. But to get off Hellraiser and move into kind of you know, another kind of area, Loomis is somebody who's notorious for wonderful.
I was just gonna say, there's a lot of great lines from Halloween, and Loomis talks about, even when he's in the house with the police officer and they're talking about like the dead dog and he got hungry, and then he's talking about when he was with Michael in the institution and the devil's eyes and these things, and I'm just like, man, that's
the devil's eyes, the blackest eye.
I even like the line where just where he says something funny. I think he has a chuckle to himself when he's outside of the house in the bushes and he yells at the kids,
"Get your ass away from me!"
Yeah, and he yells at the kids to stay off the porch, and they're just like, "Oh my God, this creepy old man hanging down the bushes." But there's a lot of great lines from Loomis.
"Evil has come to your little town, Sheriff." You know, all of that is just
come home. Just that's one of the big lines, and I think it may have been a tagline for the film at one point. There's just so many good ones. And I think I'm just going to jump into then, because, and you may say Pinhead, but, you know, if you had to choose one horror villain, slasher, monster, demon, whatever, that you would like never have to face in real life because it's just too scary, you know, who would it be and why?
Honestly, this is a tricky question because it wouldn't be any one villain. And this is going to sound like I'm saying this because of COVID, and I'm really not. But I think the viral side of horror films, the even, you know, more Lovecraft kind of sci-fi kind of unknown. I know one of the topics that you guys raised before this chat was a recent horror film that I had seen that kind of upset me or scared me, you know, or that I really enjoyed. And I watched it recently, and I just watched it again, The Beach House. There's something basically, I'm not spoiling anything because this is a newer film and I want to give people a chance to see it, but basically it has to deal with the world changing and shifting. And it's, so it's not necessarily a virus, you know, as strictly defined. You know, it's not like, oh, well, you know, somebody sneezed on me and I caught it and now I'm sick. It's more, there's a thing going on. And again, I'm not giving anything away. It is waterborne. I'll say that and I'll leave it there. But that type of thing is what scares me most. And I think it's probably because of the world we're living in right now. There's all kinds of different things going on that are, you know, at least for me, every day I hear something in the news that I'm like, that there's no way that's real. And it's real. It's a real thing. You know, it's, there's just so much going on that I don't know if it's me getting old or the world advancing at such a rapid pace, but there's just so many things that I just could never have imagined being real things we're exploring. And, the reaches of science and such, that I think that fear of the unknown, the fear of some outside kind of agitator, some major restructuring of the world as we know it, kind of changing things and changing the way we live. And I know that sounds very hokey because we're all in quarantine dealing with COVID stuff. But I don't know. I just think it hits different. Films like Color Out of Space, The Beach House, films that deal with something completely outside our realm of understanding that are taking over, changing things and you know, disrupting things. Annihilation, another great example. Those films scare me the most lately. And I think that's just directly related to the fact that every day I hear about something new that blows my mind. And I just worry that at some point the other shoe is going to drop and, you know, we're going to get a little too far ahead of ourselves or we're going to unleash something on ourselves. And yeah. I never imagined we would spend a year indoors because of essentially like a super flu. So, you know, there's a lot of surprising things happening in the world.
Yeah, I'll say it's no coincidence that a film like Contagion that came out a while ago All of a sudden was on the top 10 on Netflix come March when we went into lockdown, right? And it's not only that, oh, this thing is happening that we never thought could actually happen. It's that we're going back and referencing this film where this thing actually kind of happened and trying to find some kind of answer, right? Or meaning in this film because it's something that we didn't think was possible, right? But the fear of infection and death has always been around. And it's not, I think it's used. I mean, when you think about it from the zombie film perspective, it's used a lot, but that's a little bit different. That is the seen version of infection.
Yeah, absolutely. When you watch a film like Color Out of Space, there's just an event. And while it's not uncommon in a lot of these types of films, right? There's a major catastrophic of some type of event, whether it's, well, I shouldn't say major catastrophic. They could be minor events. They could be localized to one family, but there's an event that happens. And in the process of trying to understand the event itself, there's other things going on under the surface, changes happening that the main cast of characters can't keep up with because they're still trying to figure out what the event was about. Never mind the shift, the change in everything that they see and know and feel and everything around them. And that idea of, as advanced as we are, something happening that just throws us on our heels and makes us not be able to keep up with the changes going on around, it's a scary thought. You know, when you're going, hey, there's a friggin' meteor in my front yard, and meanwhile you're not noticing that, you know, your entire family, your whole world around you is changing. There's just something about that. I don't know. Again, like I said, maybe it's me getting old. And It Follows is a great movie in terms of that thing that you're in the process of trying to even just understand the thing, never mind combat it. And it's meanwhile, it's taking over and it's ending things around you. Not only is it a great movie, super, super well done film, but it's very much along those same lines. The idea that, you know, we think we know so much, but we know so little. And there's always something just waiting to kind of topple the king or queen.
Yeah, definitely. And I love that the way you put that as well. Like, there's always something waiting in the wings. Mm-hmm. And yeah, okay, let's not be like, oh, that sounds paranoid. But the thing is that most of the time we're going through the motions and not thinking about these kinds of things. And now 2020 has put it in the perspective of where it's in our face all the time. All the time. And it's not just that it's something that we're talking about. It's in the media constantly. So it's like in the news and things like that. So it's something that's always in your face too. So it's not like a problem you can just ignore, and nor should you. And that's scary too. And then there's a constant sort of similar to, we'll put it in like Michael Myers or Halloween terms. There's always something looming, the pressure. Yeah. The buildup, and it just keeps building and it hasn't popped yet.
Well, and one of the interesting things about fear of the unknown and these tales that are all, you know, kind of built off Lovecraft themes, you know, Lovecraft used a lot of these things to kind of tell stories of, with a very different and very disturbing kind of subtext about race and the world. Lovecraft was not a good person, right? Lovecraft had a lot of terrible opinions and ideas and things that, you know, as big as his impact is on the world of horror, there's that huge caveat that goes along with it that, you know, the man himself was not a good person. And he wove a lot of his problematic thoughts, ideals, and opinions into his works. And so it's a tough thing to talk about the fear of the unknown and such without noting that. But it's also important to recognize that, again, as much as I think it bears repeating every time Lovecraft is brought up that he was a terrible person and had these terrible ideas, and there's that huge disclaimer and caveat tied to all of his work, I think that it also kind of goes to show that work that is kind of prime, in a sense, work that like his, that is so important to a genre and so kind of outside the you know, confines of time. It's the word's on the tip of my tongue and I'm struggling to find it, but basically it's timeless, to sound corny. You can always find another layer of subtext, a different way that you see and view these things. And I think that science and science fiction evils are kind of the next iteration of that. And I think that viruses and disease and things like that kind of play into this. And this is why we see these resurgences. Obviously, when he wrote these things, he was writing about, you know, he was writing kind of like an allegory for race and racial puritanical bullshit that the man believed. But it takes a new form and a new shape throughout time, because these tales kind of will always scare us. The tales he told will always be horrifying to humankind. And you find different ways, you know, to kind of capitalize on that inner fear. And yes, he's no longer capitalizing on the fear of like incoming hordes of people who don't quite look the same. Now he's capitalizing on the fear of the unknown being, you know, again, science, disease, you know, outer space, whatever the case. So yeah, the fear of the unknown is something that is strong and will never go away. And I think that timeless work like Lovecraft's, as much as the man was a monster himself, timeless work like Lovecraft's, you're always going to find something, you know, these periodic moments in history that kind of you see a resurgence in it. And right now is a perfect example of that. I think current times, COVID world, is a perfect example of, you know, finding a new way to relate to his work.
Well, I think that, you know, throughout history, there's a lot we can point to where we look at things in the pursuit of science and knowledge that are extremely problematic, sure, and horrifying, that make for, you know, good works of horror, because it, is something that speaks to our core fears.
Any thoughts on Lovecraft Country?
So I haven't completely finished it, but what I've seen so far, I think it's amazing. I think that I think it's pretty great too. It's a pretty amazing way to take a notorious racist's work and you know, kind of twist it and reinvent it. And I think that it's a wonderful thing. And I think that, honestly, I think it's introducing a whole new group of people to Lovecraft, for better or worse. And again, Lovecraft is such a terrible topic. It's not a terrible topic, but such a tricky topic to talk about because the guy was a misogynist. The guy was a racist. He was so many terrible, terrible things. But to ignore his impact on horror and science fiction, it's borderline impossible to ignore the impact of Lovecraft on these genres. So as much as it's a terrible topic to talk about, there's a part of me that feels like, hey, talking about these things is educational for everybody. And I'm no scholar. I'm just a horror fan. So every time I have one of these conversations about Lovecraft, I find myself learning a lot as well. And I think that those conversations are important. You know, I think that anytime you go, well, the guy was a scumbag, fucking write him off and forget all his work and blah, 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 blah. You know, I think that we are doing ourselves a disservice and injustice there to not analyze and talk further about it. You know, the concept of fear of the unknown, that can be a lot of different things. And sure, to him, the fear of the unknown was kind of rooted in racism and rooted in some terrible things. But I think that that's, again, timeless, fear of the unknown. I think that you can be afraid of the unknown without being a racist. And so that's where his work kind of, you know, gets beyond the terrible person that created it. And I think with Lovecraft Country and the themes of race and you know, civil rights era, kind of the timing of it, I think that that brings a whole new kind of approach to it, a whole new spin. And I think that it plays very well for the folks that are, you know, there's the scene where Atticus and Letitia and can't remember the uncle's name, but they're driving through the sundown towns, the sundown counties, right? And that is very much, I don't want to say it's the inverse, but you know, Lovecraft and his fear of you know, the of other races and such, that's a really interesting way to kind of nod to that, because you have black folk, you know, traveling through a place that is very, very unknown to them, and their fear of the unknown is the fear of the unknown that you're playing on. And I just think it's a really interesting way to kind of turn the tables, flip the script there, and show something that is usually very problematic material, but showed in a new way. And I think that, again, being that those elements are so timeless and that we keep seeing them come back in film, obviously they aren't going anywhere. So we need some new ways to experience them. And I think Lovecraft Country did a lot to go in that direction. I do have to say that I think where I'm at, the point I'm at in the season, it's starting to get a little all over the place and it's starting to lose me a little, but I'm hoping that it comes back around again. And I'll be finishing it up soon, but yeah, Lovecraft Country is one of those things that I'm extremely late to the party on because, you know, streaming services, basically. I'm not going to start bitching about streaming services, but man, there was a time where cutting the cord and getting rid of cable and going to streaming was a great thing. Now it seems like there's 7,000 different streaming services you have to get each month in order to see all the things. And it's, you know, so yeah, basically HBO Max and their nonsense is what kept me from Lovecraft Country until now. But I am catching up, and I do hope that this detour in the mid section of the season, I hope it comes back around and grabs me again. It started to fade on me a little bit and I took a little time away, but I think overall, all in all, the great success of Lovecraft Country is not only retelling those problematic stories and retelling them from a different perspective, which sounds so obvious, but again, the simple fact that fear of other races was what motivated a lot of Lovecraft's work, and you have you're seeing the fear of other races from a different side of things. You're literally seeing the story inverted, I think is really interesting and really creative. And I think it's going to bring, you know, some of this, it's going to bring a greater understanding of some of Lovecraft's work to a whole new crowd of horror and sci-fi fans. So in that respect, it's a huge success, even if the season does lose me here, but I am really hoping that, that it pulls me back in again.
I definitely want to ask you, Matt, what is sort of a favorite, you know, kill or death scene that you might have from a horror film, and can you tell us why? Because there's always those ones that really stick with us.
Every day, the sleeping bag kill on Friday the 13th. All day, every day, most horrifying kill is the sleeping bag kill on Friday the 13th. Because when you're a kid and you go, I went camping all summer long for every summer for damn near a decade as a kid. And when you're a kid and you're in a tent and you're scared, you kind of huddle down in your sleeping bag, and your sleeping bag is your safe spot. You know, you pull the sleeping bag up around your ears and you try to hide in your sleeping bag, and that's going to make you safe. And so something about the sleeping bag kill just messed me up. I was like, I'm not even safe in my damn sleeping bag. This isn't fair. That's the safe place when you're camping. Jason picked up the sleeping bag and smacked it against a tree. That kill messed me up as a kid. But
yeah, and we see that kill in the game, which is one of my favorites. I always make it a point to get into a tent, just like in it. There was the last time I played, actually, I got into a tent and I was almost, there was only 2 minutes left, but they found me at the very last minute and smushed me against
a
tree.
It's almost worth it. So. It's almost worth it to just stay in the tent because you're like, they're going to get me against a tree. But I mean, I do have to also give a nod to Hellraiser. There's a lot of really, really amazing stuff in Hellraiser. So yeah, there's not a high body count in Hellraiser, but when the Cenobites come out, and I'm talking entire franchise, I don't mean just Hellraiser 1. When the Cenobites come out, you're guaranteed to get something gory and something amazing. So yeah, honorable mention to the Hellraiser franchise there.
Among many honorable Hellraiser franchise mentions, for sure. There's a lot of great stuff in that. And well, even from the first one, there's like right off the bat, there's some stuff that's really disturbing. I think that was one of the first films where I watched something and there was like a body, like completely removed of flesh.
Yep.
Right. And for me, I was like, oh my God. Like that was terrifying for me. Seeing the tissue and the muscle and the, you know, just like goopy viscera of everything. And then this is a body reanimated and it's talking to its lover. Yep. Right. I think was that Frank? I'm gonna
that's
get
Uncle
confused.
Frank, yeah. That's Frank.
That is it. Uncle Frank, yeah. I was like, this is Frank, right? And talking to his lover. And it's just this interesting thing of like, and she's not when she's talking to him, she's not disturbed by it at all.
They start making out and you're just like, oh, come on. He doesn't even have skin. You know, what are you doing?
Yeah, that's one of the scenes where I'm like, oh God, I can't watch.
So, bone and muscle arms shoot up out of the attic floor and then he just comes up out of the, oh man, yeah. But I mean, there's also the Jesus wept scene where Uncle Frank is now, this is riddled with spoilers about Hellraiser, but who cares? The movie came out in 1987. If you haven't seen it yet, like, I don't know what the hell you're doing with your life, but Uncle Frank is wearing the father's skin and the Cenobites catch up with him and they got the hooks and chains all in his face, pulling on his face, and his face is about to rip apart and his mouth is all stretched and weird and his tongue's hanging out and he licks his lips and goes, Jesus wept. And then it just rips him apart. Phenomenal. That part is amazing. And so yeah, it's a low kill count, but man, you want to talk about some crazy kills.
There's some great films with a low kill count though, when we think about it. And I guess, can you think of one in particular outside of Hellraiser? I'm gonna put that on there. that is probably like a favorite of yours where the kill count's not high, but the film and the way that the kills are done, I think makes it, and maybe it's not even the kills, but the whole package really just makes the film, despite the
Thing
count.
Definitely comes to mind because as much as The Thing has a significant, there's a significant amount of kills in it. I mean, the whole group at Outpost 31 die, but the way they die is not always typical horror movie. The way they die is not typical horror movie at all. I mean, you know, they burst into crazy creatures or, you know, in the case of Wilford Brimley, I want to come back and try now. They just, you know, they're kind of, it's the question, the big question in The Thing is, did they turn? Are they, you know, being replicated or not? You know what I mean? Are they one of the aliens or not? So they're very normal looking. So The Thing stands out in that respect. As much as The Thing is packed with gore and strange things, it's not necessarily a high kill count movie. And it's not always like elaborate murder, you know, elaborate kills. It's very different in that respect.
And it's about survival. Right. Creature wise, it's about survival. The kills, the intent behind that, it's very much about survival for the creature. Right. Itself, so it's not done in a way that is eloquent and how it, you know, kills people or why it kills people. It's really just looking for a host to survive. And then how, you know, the kills actually come about is based on, you know, MacReady and everybody else in their investigation and like uncovering who's who and, you know, who is infected or the host of the parasite at that point. So it's interesting when you think about it, it's actually just it's a creature feature survival film, monster movie. Like, it's fantastic. It's definitely one of my favorites. It ranks high up there. So
and when you think about the gore and the effects in it, it's not always the kill. It's you know, some of the more memorable gore and effects has nothing to do with a kill, which is, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, even the effect of the, I don't know if it's a soldering or just like a clothes hanger or something that he heats up and sticks into the blood at that moment when he touches the blood and the blood spurts out all over, and how they did that is really interesting too. And some of the effects of just like how things split apart or open with practical effects is really interesting. So and of course being big fans of special movie effects and things like that, are what are some of your favorite films in terms of just the practical effects, special effects, monster creature makeup effects?
Well, honestly, you know, there's the gang of special effects guys. You have Savini, Botine, Baker, Nicotero, those guys. But Rob Botine, he's really the one that stands out the most to me. He did The Thing. He also did Seven, for example. You know, he did The Fog. He's worked with John Carpenter quite a bit, but Botine also is the special effects artist behind the werewolf transformation in The Howling, which is one of my favorite werewolf transformations, which, you know, I think is worth mentioning. He did Total Recall, RoboCop. I mean, Botine is one of those people that anything the guy does is pretty impressive. And I feel similarly about Nicotero. Greg Nicotero, trained by Tom Savini, kind of, you know, came up through that whole Pittsburgh Romero Tom Savini thing, and Nicotero, yeah, he's definitely somebody that I really love, you know, all the way through to Walking Dead. But in terms of effects and creature effects, I think that was the applicable question. I definitely want to say The Thing. I think The Thing is like one of those high watermarks for practical effects. But I've always been very kind of amazed by the things that Tom Savini did. And the reason I have to put that in there, even though Botine and The Thing, that's, you know, obviously a high watermark, the way Savini handles death in the films he's worked on, you know, the idea of, he said it a million times in a million interviews, how leaving as much of the real in there as possible so that the amount of makeup work that's being done, the amount of fake elements that are being done are minimal in order to keep the viewer feeling like that was a real thing they saw. He just is a master of that trickery. There's makeup, there's practical effects, there's creating a monster like in The Thing that is, in my opinion, super impressive and respectable and something that I love. But there's also the sleight of hand kind of almost magic that Savini does that makes him just such a brilliant makeup effects artist and such a brilliant mind in the film industry, because it's not just about creating the big monster that's, you know, horrifying. There's also the sleight of hand going in. There's the axe that comes down and kills the girl in Friday the 13th that nicks the light so that you can get a sense for how the axe is real and not foam. You know, little things like that he thinks about doing, you know, oh, well, if we bump the light with this axe, it's going to hit the light and make that metal clang sound right before it hits the actress in the editing process. So, you know, you're left with that light just bumped into that light. I mean, the axe just bumped into that light fixture. That's a real metal axe. And then it's already in the girl's, you know, face. So you kind of, it's more than just creating an elaborate prank to make it look like something terrible happened. It's a lot of sleight of hand and knowing, you know, Savini knowing four steps ahead in the editing room what they can do with that footage and what they can make that look like. So I think it's it, Tom Savini is somebody that you can't understate, basically. As much as there are people who do cool shit and super creative shit, you know, spider heads and things like that in The Thing and tubes and gore and all that blood and pus and guts, you know, there's something about Savini and that magic trick that he manages to do with every one of his scenes that I think is super impressive.
I'm definitely a big Savini fan, and I have to say, I definitely agree with you on all of that as well. I have a couple more questions, or we have a couple more questions that we want to ask before we let you go, because I know we're running a little bit over. But so in terms of Final Girls, this is a super popular trope. It's the trope that will never die. It's going to be around for as long as we live. But do you have a favorite Final Girl, and you, like, who is it? Can you tell us why? From any film.
Well, you know, I mean, honestly, I've been talking about Hellraiser a lot, so I hate to bring up Hellraiser again, but Ashley Lawrence in Hellraiser, she is a very interesting kind of final girl in the respect that she gets one over on the Cenobites, and I've always found that super impressive. She, you know, she plays Kirsty Cotton in the original Hellraiser, and she's back in Hellraiser 2. And I believe she's back for a sequel or two much, much later. But really, it's that first film and how she kind of, you know, she calls the Cenobites. And under the normal rules of the lore, they would be after her, right? But she managed to tell them, hey, Frank escaped you. He got away from you. And I can get him to you. I can give him back to you in exchange for my life. She basically plays the Cenobites. And the interesting thing about her as a final girl is that there's never a moment in it where she's helpless, where she's, oh, bewildered. And she's a very strong final girl in that respect. I think she's a very impressive final girl. And I think that she's a very creative way to use the final girl. The fact that she basically, like I said, she knows that the Cenobites, they're not going to want to hear about a failing of theirs. And Frank is very much a failing of theirs. Frank escaped them, got away from them. He's back. He's on Earth again. She uses that as her own leverage to, you know, kind of set Frank up, who's killed her father, and get her vengeance on Frank, but also to evade the Cenobites. And so I think there's something really cool about that. Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween, I feel like you have to bring it up simply because I think that when the term final girl kind of gets out there, I think of two people, at least. I think of Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween, and I think of Marilyn Burns as Sally Hardesty in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The reason I think those two just immediately come to mind is Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween. It's like quintessential final girl stuff. And Marilyn Burns in Texas Chainsaw, the scene with her where they're like the up close shots of her bloodshot eye at the dinner table, or when she's escaping in the back of the pickup truck. I feel like those two roles are really kind of the core of what the final girl trope is about. I think, and not that it hasn't evolved over time, it has evolved in great ways over time, but I think that that's the origins of that final girl trope, and I think that they were the originals, and so, you know, there's something to note there. But yeah, Ashley Lawrence in Hellraiser is definitely right up there with them. So, but yeah, I mean, you know, really, yeah. Last thought. When you think about a final girl, Sally Hardesty riding away in the back of that pickup truck is pretty fucking iconic. You know what I mean? Like, covered in blood, screaming, kind of half screaming, laughing, sitting in the back of a pickup truck, driving down the road. Like, that's like way final girl moment right there.
Yeah, no, I was going to say definitely really great choices. And we have seen it evolve, but I think ultimately the final girl, it's when we see final girls oftentimes at the start, it's someone who's soft, unassuming. Yeah. They seem weak, right? And there's this inner strength that's found to survive and stay alive. And we get some interesting stuff out of that. I was talking, I was talking with Reba before about the character of Erin from Your Next. And how interesting it was because, like, she's not, they set it up so you think she is, but actually, she's this, like, very, she's a survivalist and was trained to survive. And, you might assume this normal final girl trope about her, but like she was a badass from the moment she walked in the room. You just didn't know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think that again, I don't want to say my favorite, but I think the type of true crime inspired stories that fascinate me the most would be home invasion, which is why movies like The Strangers or Funny Games come up. Those types of films, because there's so much that you don't know. The news says, home invasion last night left, three people dead, and they found the three people. They don't know what happened to them in the process of that. They don't know, you know what I mean? And so that definitely is something that fascinates me, because it kind of takes a dark look at what might happen in that scenario. Another one that comes to mind is Amityville Horror. Because whether or not you believe the Amityville Horror happened or how it happened or all of that, a family died in that house and then another family moved in and quickly moved out because shit got weird. So that right there is true enough for me to make it interesting. And now, of course, the movie, again, it's a movie. They take certain creative license, but Amityville Horror was something that always fascinated me. And I grew up on the East Coast too. So, the Amityville Horror House is a real house out in Amityville, Long Island. So you can go see it if you want. But a family was murdered there. And then another family moved in and had to move right out again out of fear of being murdered. So, there's some truth in there. And whether or not it was spirits, ghosts, evil, Satan himself, whether the walls bled or not, that's still a horrifying story.
Well, there's something about any film that involves some kind of possession, whether it be demonic or paranormal in terms of ghosts and things like that, that fascinates me personally. A lot of what people point to in terms of why they did what they did, etc. Yeah. And the idea of it being this other entity that was influencing them. It's always really interesting to me.
One takeaway from this, please go watch Hellraiser. I don't know why I'm on such a Hellraiser kick, but I am. I'm on like this crazy Hellraiser kick. They're talking about doing a Hellraiser TV show and reboots and all kinds of other fun stuff.
I did hear about that. That's really exciting. I actually would be very interested to see a Hellraiser TV show, but I don't want the sort of fantastical and extreme nature of the death stuff or to be watered down for television.
I think it's an HBO
because,
one.
There's TV-14 and I'm like, can you do it? But if it's HBO, then yeah, I think we're fine. Good. Right.
And Clive Barker is involved after, petitioning for his rights to the original content and all that. So that's good news. Number one is good news because the petitioning for the rights all worked out quick and relatively painless compared to some other instances we've seen in recent history. So that's a good thing, and also Clive is attached to it now. So I'm really hype about it. And I don't know, I've also been really getting into, I collect a lot of vinyl records, and my Secret Santa got me the Hellraiser 2 score on vinyl. And so if you haven't checked out the score to Hellraiser 1 and Hellraiser 2, they're done by, I want to say it's Christopher Young, and they're amazing. They're these big arrangements and it just so very Hellraiser. It's just such a unique franchise. And so during quarantine, I've been on a recent Hellraiser kick again and remembering my early inspirations in horror. And so if there's one takeaway from this entire episode, please go watch Hellraiser again. Some good stuff.
That's one thing I forgot to ask about your memorabilia. I'm going to have to ask really quick before we go. Tell me all about what horror memorabilia you collect.
I collect literally anything and everything having to do with horror movies. I mean, I collect horror movie soundtracks on vinyl. I'm a physical media person, so I really like special edition Blu-rays and things like that. I like, collecting vinyl soundtracks. I like collecting VHS copies of movies. I'm big on physical media for sure. But I mean, my collecting is kind of out of control and all over the place. Everything from, horror themed pillows and blankets and shirts to, action figures and pops and vinyl soundtracks and Blu-rays and posters. And I mean, there's one surefire way to sucker me into spending money, and that's tell me that this is a limited edition anything and I'm buying it. I'm a sucker for collectibles. And one of these days I have to do like a video tour of the house and all this I mean, I have rooms and rooms and rooms and stacks and stacks and stacks of things that I just amass over time. But my vinyl collection is something I'm extremely proud of. Yeah. And it's growing every day. Yeah, the vinyl record collecting is something that is more recent for me, but there's so much out there and there's so many cool limited, you know, limited color variant vinyl of this and pressing of that and album artwork by this person. And I mean, you can get deep into it, but ultimately that's really what it's about. Like you said about Scream, you know, you have a special attachment to that film. So then you have a special attachment to that soundtrack. And when you have this physical item, you know, there's something about the process of records also, you know, brushing in with the record cleaning brush and, you know, gently setting them in the thing. It's different than clicking on a button and listening to a soundtrack. There's a whole process to it. There's the process of, once I put this record on, I'm listening to all of side A. You know what I mean? I'm not skipping around. I'm not hitting the next track button. I'm going to sit down and enjoy this. There's a whole process to it. I equate it to, I love coffee. And I'll drink a cup of coffee out of any kind of coffee machine or coffee pot on the planet because I love coffee. But there's something about grinding some coffee beans, putting them in a French press, pressing a hot cup of coffee, and you pour that cup of coffee and there's a whole process to it that makes it somehow more enjoyable. That's what I equate vinyl records to. Yes, you can go find these soundtracks online and click buttons and listen to them, or you can have that whole experience. And you know, like for you to say, oh, you know, I just got the Scream record because it's, you know, it's a film that's very special to me. That's perfect. That's exactly it. You know, and I'm sure when you sit down and listen to that, you have all this flooding of cool memories and things. And that whole process is just magic.
Well, Matt, thank you so much again for coming to hang out with us on the Slayaway podcast. Can you tell us really quick about Radio for the Creeps and where people can find you on the internet?
Well, Radio for the Creeps is my podcast talking shit basically about all things horror, just jibber jabber and all things horror. You can find it anywhere that you listen to podcasts. It's up and it's out. Season 2 coming soon. And yeah, you can also follow me on socials at Matt Shotcha everywhere, on every social channel there is. So please do feel free to reach out to me, especially on Twitter, and tell me that I'm wrong, or you know, let's debate the finer points of Hellraiser together.
Hey Slayers, if you liked that episode, please go and give us a review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. We'd really appreciate it. And be sure to go check out slayawaywithus.com for more reviews and essays on our favorite genre, horror.